And if it comes out half good, we'll get it up and John can have a listen if he wishes to. So thank you. This is the second of two readings. We have no future bookings at this point. We'll start off with Ned Kelly and me. I grew up in the Ned Kelly town of Beechworth. I know that Greta had the hideout, Jerilderie got his important mail, and Glen Rowan had his very last stand. But when I grew up, Beechworth was the only true Ned Kelly town. As boys, my mate and I laid out an elaborate ambush to stop all the tourist traffic rubbernecking around the gorge. We sat up on Pumpkin Rock, and I was absolutely Ned. And my mate was Ned too, but I was just a little bit bigger. The buses and cars didn't care who was the biggest Ned because they were backed up for half a mile, waiting for the barricade we'd laid across the road to be cleared. And the two of us Neds hightailed it into the scrub. We didn't stop till we were laughing like drains at our camp in a bedroom at the back of his mother's place. When I was a lump of a teenager, folk dances were all the rage, and I know that Ned was a stomper once or twice himself. Listen closely. Can you hear them now, the concertina and the fiddle? Form a circle, take your partner for a pride of Erin, then a barn dance. We kicked our heels in the air every time they started a jig. It seems to me that there's a feeling in such dance, some connection to the past, and I wondered more than once if what we did was in the nature of an echo. We wore our beards long when we became men. It was the thing to do at the time. Everyone I knew looked like he had a touch of Kelly in the blood. But when I travelled to the city, all I saw was clean shaves that moved too fast, too slick, until I longed for the gorge and the ranges and the honey granite rocks that shaped my town. Just take a look at the jail and the courthouse to see what I mean, and take a good look while you're about it at Ned Kelly's personal cell. I think all of us at some time imagined him there, run to the bad by the circumstances of his life and his place in those events. We were proud in our way that we knew a bit about Ned. And here I am, returned again to the town. I know a lot now about rules and the law, but I know some things too about right and wrong and justice. So I'm glad that I don't have to pass judgment on the subject of Ned Kelly. In a funny way, a funny little small town way, he's helped to make me the man that I've become. And while I'm no saint, I always do the best that I possibly can. That's good enough for me, and I thank my southern stars that I grew up in the town that captured acclaim to Ned Kelly. Welcome.
Thank you. Sorry, Frank. It's so late. We were talking.
Oh, well, that happens in a town
Like
like
we were talking
Beechworth.
about coming here.
And here you are. Welcome. Welcome. A bloke's poem for the garden. It's called A Husky Roar. I am the grass cutter. Nothing's going to stand in my way. I'll jump aboard the ride-on mower and drive. Cruise up to the back fence, cut a straight, undeviated line, swing it wide to the right and then turn down. Hustle, hustle, run. It's been sunny, but on a mowing day, there's every chance of rain. So here I fly at 5 miles per hour. Listen to my husky roaring like a bladed demon. And my grass is lawn again, beautiful and green, except for the soggy bit, the rough and rocky bit, and that part over there where I smote the fence with my bull bar. Yes, but I am the grass cutter. Listen to my husky roar. Oh, I love my husky. Couple of poems from the Small Town Kid collection. A couple of toilet poems from the Small Town Kid collection. For anyone who doesn't remember, although most of us seem to be of an age, back in the day, the quarter acre block, the toilet was at the furthest point in the on the property, with a bit of a run to get to it. It was a wooden structure generally, trapdoor at the back for cans going in, cans going out, and the like. And my very first memory is of my grandpa seen peeping through a crack in the back door of the toilet. It's called Half Moon at the Trap Door. Twin pink half moon expanses of flesh protrude, almost disembodied, from a snug fit that seals the wooden circle tightly. Two watchers suppress a giggle, overawed at the sight stolen through the gap at the top of the trapdoor. Little mischiefs. And of course, to look after such a toilet, you had to have the nightmare. Antiseptic tablets, poo and pee. I suppose that must be what the smell is. Always accompanied by the incessant buzz of fat blowflies and the wriggling disgust of yellow-white maggots. Hallmarks of the outhouse at the back of the garden, as far from the residence as possible. Once each week, the nightman, in his dirty overalls and smells, stops the truck, lined one side with full cans and the other with empties, outside on the street, in the early hours of morning or after darkness has fallen. Always running, with an empty can on his shoulder, up the length of the driveway to the back of the garden. A thump on the outhouse wall is his warning. Open the trapdoor, full one out, swap the lids, new one in, thump the wall, all clear. Hoist the full can onto the shoulder and run to the truck. He tripped once, fell. All our recent history exposed and putrid on the road in front of the house, where usually we preferred to keep it rather more discreet. When I was a young fellow, my heroes were the Rabbitohs. I always tried to be a rabbit trapper, very unsuccessful, but there were some that that could do the job. It's an ode to the Rabbitoh. A line of nails head high on the paling fence. A sharp knife and fast hands are the basic requirements of the Rabbitoh. 100 pair of bunnies after a night of spotlighting or setting traps need speed in the emerging sun of morning. Gutted and scun in 30 seconds each, skins are stretched wide to dry, inside out on wire. Red meat is placed on white ice, fast, to avoid the risk of spoiling before delivery to customers as the day heats up. Would you like a pair, missus? They're fresh this morning, only your husband did some work for me and I wanted to say ta. There were a lot of rabbits in those days, and I think they're all making a big comeback, only we don't trap them anymore. McAlpin's cherries. As young people, we played at being fruit pickers in the season, and I certainly played at being a fruit picker in the season. McAlpin's cherries. In the weeks of heat and holidays, the cherry-lined branches are burdened deep purple or black or red with the promised succulence that's revealed through the light loam dust that's raised by a shower of passing rain. The trees stand in leafy straight lines over and around the hillside, categorised by variety and the timing of their readiness, set wide enough apart for the tractor to deposit and collect bins of the picked fruit, taken singly or in joined clusters of twins and triplets that may straddle a teenage ear in a moment of unproductive decoration. The gun pickers fill their buckets in what seems like just a moment, up and down the ladders to strip a tree and move on to the next, in the time that it takes to have a good look around, a sip of tea from the thermos. My poultry efforts might be improved if I wasn't afraid of ladders since the apples of last season flung me to the ground. And perhaps I'd last longer before getting sacked if my friend and I weren't fighting cherry-dodging battles with juicy missiles flying between adjoining rows, to the irritation of the boss, old Mac McAlpin, during his daily inspections of the adequacy and progress being made by the casual labour. His free advice to novice pickers resounds with a wealth of acquired orchardist wisdom and kindliness when he tells us in a bird brogue, "Boys, if you're gonna eat 'em, eat the bird-pecked ones. They're the sweetest." It's good advice, But after 3 days, I never want to see or touch one of those red devils again.
Tell about that, Faith.
Yeah, I can associate.
Some random characters coming up, excuse me. Lady at work, a while back, shared a piece of her home life with me. She had a skill that she said a woman wasn't supposed to have, and she was subject to criticism for it over time. This is called witchy wire. He said, "Put away your witchy wire, woman. There's no need for it here. I can find your water." "Well, well, clever man, show me where you say it lies, and let my boy tell you where I found the precious life, and we'll see. I don't know where it came from, but my sister and I both could follow the water lines from when we were kids. There was no laid pipe could hide from us, every one we found. My grandfather had the gift himself, but he didn't teach it, the old curmudgeon. He'd give you nothing but his certainty and his scorn. For me, it's a twist of gauge wire with a short handle and a long end out front. It acts like a sudden song when there's water below. My hands grow hot and close to blisters. If I hold the witch up in the air, she spins like a mad thing. That's the sign of water. I'm only a woman, and they say divining's a man's work, but I can hold the witchy wire, and when I tell you here's the water, here be water, be a man and dig." So he went through the paddock, this great finder, and he declared it, "Here, and yes, it's here." And so it was, for my man confirmed that the wire in my hand had seen those places long before him. The single male shopper, I don't know if any of you might have encountered a single male shopper in your journeys.
Not often.
Let me introduce you. He looks clean enough, but seems crumpled, as though he's been through the wash, but somehow eluded the iron. Perhaps he's lost, or just vague. Certainly, he appears distracted as he propels the trolley up and down each and every aisle. A man who possesses no list of what is needed, but hopes to know it when he sees it. Needles. Sewing needles. Should he or shouldn't he? The decision requires inordinate consideration and study halfway along the sundry goods shelf. Perhaps he's peering not at the price, but into a future that he can only glimpse myopically, trying to picture himself reattaching a button that hasn't yet unravelled from a shirt that he hasn't yet worn. Imagining a domestic situation with himself as the chief protagonist. No, and there's nothing needed for the laundry. He becomes more decisive in meat, where the veal schnitzel is particularly attractive. Always easy to do in the fry pan. 2 packs, one for tonight and one to freeze. Vegetables warrant hardly a glance. Another sign, perhaps, of the limitations of his imagination. Grapes, though. Yes, grapes are good. Soft drink, cheese slices, salami small goods, a packet of gummy bears, milk and yoghurt, pre-packed fettuccine with a microwave sauce, 1 quiche. A 6-pack of meat pies snap freezes him for a moment in the chill section as he pauses to visualise again. This time it's an image of the space available inside his own freezer at home before he moves on to toilet paper, toothpaste, paracetamol, shampoo. No condoms. No socks, no jockettes, no razors, no soap. Ah, apple juice on special on a corner where it catches the eye. He steers to the checkout, to the only counter where cigarettes are sold, for a carton of gaspers to conclude. Pauses at the exit of the shop, pondering, as if trying to recall an item that should have been on the non-existent list. Shrugs his shoulders and wanders towards the lotto outlet. Tonight, he could get lucky. Another character piece, an anti-war poem that I wrote some years back when I was working in Melbourne and around the Dandenong area, which has always been a great migrant receiving area. This is an anti-war piece called Zlata's Daughter. I met Zlatica when I was young on a visit to the old country. We held hands at the village dance and walked evenings on the Korozo. When I left, she gave me golden dice on a chain and said, Osieche me, remember me. Zlata is a mother now, a grandmother, a survivor of war between Croats and Serbs. I can't understand what the hell they thought they were doing to those places where we went to talk and to dream and hold hands as we walked on the quarters or cobbles. Zlata named her daughter Mariana Srcemoj, my heart. And she grew up an imitation Amerikanka in a landscape painted small with dinars instead of dollars. She met Dejan on the Korozo before a dance. Mariana couldn't help herself, fell for a Serb, and Dejan chose wrong blood, Mariana a Croat. There was hatred in the village for kids like that, betrayers of kin, consorts of the enemy, damn fool pacifists. He should have shaved her hair and put her out on the street. She should have cut his throat in the middle of the night. I met Zlata's daughter, her Dejan, and their child at a migrant place in Dandenong. She told me it was better here. Australians haven't learned to wear the look that gets etched into faces from living with war. She said she was a little lonely. No one from home comes to visit, but they paint messages on the outside wall. You know, no place here for a Croatian Serb. No place here for a Serbian Croat. No place here for mongrels like you. Go away. Go away. Become invisible. She said they would leave in the morning and go to a small faraway town where no one knows where they come from, who they are, what they are. They'll finally put the war behind them and find a place where their child will grow, without an accent, without a heritage, but without knowing hate. When I last saw her, Zlata's daughter was wearing a golden dice on a necklace, struggling with a language full of strange new words and keeping up a job through difficult, hard early times. I picture her now in my mind's eye, walking with Dejan and their daughter on a dusty Australian korozo in a tiny town she calls Moje Oslobođenje, my escape to freedom. Mm. Tough gig with living in a war zone. Mm. Writing in the moon. I have a great affinity for writing moon poems. Some reason I look up in the night and there it is again. Writing in the moon. Shall I write for you, dear reader, the way a fish might do, in swirls and circles through the water, barely faint disturbance to the placid surface, all energy undercurrent. Alternative, the wagtail, curlicues and exclamations spattered all across the page, or a format memoranda of an excitement hard contained. Should I pen my name in sparkler red and orange, in a continuous flow of letters, until the glow fades and you cannot see me writ before you any more? Ought I for you as the feather, quilling in a free float of words that gentle around suggested meanings and take their time to reach a point, but pretty, so very pretty on their wafted way. Perhaps you'd care to puff them back, a never concluded sentence suspended in a mystery of air. Or better, if I etch in echoes of the words you say, you say, you say, paraphrase to let you read on paper that I can hear you clean and clear, but ever more faintly. Perhaps a smell, the way the sun imprints through heat and sear, burnt like rage at the height of noon. But no, the lunar sphere has words that seem to me more elegant. Silver was always the colour that I wrote best. I will in silver, the way the moon. The girl who had her red shoes on. Ah, well, for Karen who had her red shoes on, perhaps. I write in free verse, and I like to look for ways to introduce rhythm without rhyme and the like. And this is a little piece that where I tried to do that. The girl who had her red shoes on. She danced across the floor with her red shoes on. She clicked her heels in the air with her red shoes on. She leapt between the leaves with her red shoes on until she stood at the top of the tree. And then she tripped across the sky with her red shoes on and gambolled among the clouds with her red shoes on. She flew before the breeze with her red shoes on until she'd blown all the way round the world. And she circled the sun with her red shoes on. She swung between the planets with her red shoes on. She left a comet trail with her red shoes on. And she stopped to sleep deep in the heart of a star.
What a journey you've been on, Karen.
I was thinking of Julie Bishop.
Julie's red shoes.